And our final matter of three oral matters we have today is files, consolidated files A22, 1769, and 1770, the matter of the trust established under the pooling and servicing agreement relating to the Wachovia Bank Commercial Trust Certificate Series 2007 through C30.
Just a short case name.
Right. Yeah. And as the last case indicated, the number of attorneys doesn't necessarily reflect how much time we need to have on it, but we'll see if that's the case. We do have, and I see one attorney for appellant, so I'm assuming that means you're going to be arguing on behalf of appellants in this matter.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. And we did receive correspondence. We have three separate counsel going to be arguing, and you've divided your time 8, 5, and 2. Palomino Master is the 8. Wells Fargo is at the end with the 2, as I understand it. So we'll, the marshal will adjust the clock accordingly. We are recording this proceeding and live streaming it. So we do ask the counsel, when you do approach the podium, identify yourself for the record and whom you represent. The recording will be available within 24 hours on the Judicial Branch's website. And so counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may approach the podium and proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Art Boylan. I'm with the Anthony Austin Law Firm, and I represent the appellant, Torchlight Value Fund LLC, Torchlight Debt Opportunity Fund 2 LLC. This is a case where we found ourselves in an unusual spot. Summary judgment has been granted, meaning that the court concluded as a matter of law, the contract was clear. That's basic jurisprudence. But the court also concluded expressly, explicitly, there is no provision within the contract which expressly or explicitly allows what happened in this case.
But the court was deciding that under New York law, that the court can go beyond the four corners of the document and look at some other items.
I understand where you're
right?
going.
That's what the court concluded about New York law, which may be a little different than Minnesota in terms of how we handle ambiguities and consider extrinsic items.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think the district court had it wrong. And that's one of the errors that we've got here. The district court cited, I think, a single decision, maybe two, in saying, I can go ahead and read into the contract implied terms that otherwise are not there. And in the respondents' briefs before Your Honors, we've got extended citations to New York case law that describe or maybe repeat the same thing. But the problem with that position, Your Honor, and the problem that the mistake that the district court made is that that portion of New York law isn't so different from what we have in Minnesota. I've read those cases. I've looked at them. And what they actually do is where there is a term or a provision in a contract, they look at it and they say, maybe this is ambiguous. And then they go forward, and if they need to, they'll look at specific clauses.
I thought New York law was that you don't have to find an ambiguity before you look at some other items to decide what the contract means.
You might get that impression reading respondents' briefs, Your Honor. But if you go and read the cases don't go that far. The cases include language that says, look, it can be reasonably implied in. So, for example, there are some cases where there's a specific term at issue. What's the branding? Is this a brand that qualifies or not under the terms of our contract? The court then looks at that, looks at the contract and concludes, can analyze things and decide whether or not that provision included only one item or two items, for example.
Well, the Sutton case in New York, which I think the trial court relied on, at least suggests that you can look at what's reasonably implied by the language of a contract, even if the item is not specifically in the contract.
Right. That is what that court says, Your Honor. And I encourage you to read it because it also-
And you can do that without finding some kind of ambiguity.
I disagree with you, Your Honor. Okay. Almost every case- and
Well,
I,
how about the Sutton case? Well, did that involve an ambiguity or not?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. Respectfully, we believe it did. Here's the other thing, Your Honor. You can't divorce that from classic canons of contract construction and interpretation. And this is really critical, Your Honor. This is a 317-page agreement.
You would think that with 317 pages, anything that anybody would want in it would be in there.
Oh, I agree with you, frankly. And what you really need to do is be careful not to imply a term that runs contrary to what is in there. And that's where, Your Honor, we believe the district court really made a left turn here, a wrong left turn, because here's our facts. There's express provisions as 3.05. Once money arrives from selling off assets that are within the trust, there's specific provisions. 3.05 goes on in 24 subparts and describes you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. You can take those things away. You can take them away at that point, and it's still in what's called the certificate account. After you do that, it goes to the distribution account. Okay, simple enough. I'm a simple guy from Wilmer, frankly. I'm trying my best to keep up on this commercial mortgage-backed security stuff. After it gets out of there, there's 24 different permitted withdrawals. Then it goes to a distribution account. It's express. That's what's got to happen. And after that, it's distributed to certificate holders pursuant to a very explicit waterfall in the 317-page document. What happened here, Your Honor, after all of that happened in December of 2018, it was followed to the letter. Then there was a clawback. There's no express term providing for this. And so in contravention of all of these terms, they went and grabbed $38 million and clawed it back.
So even counsel, this is my question. Is your issue with what happened in this case the fact that the reserve was created at all, or is your issue with the fact that there was a clawback?
Sure. It's both, Your Honor, frankly, because there's the clawback makes this incredibly unique. You'll hear undoubtedly, reserves happen all the time. There were hundreds. You'll hear that, I'm sure, and you see it in their briefs.
And normally those would happen before the money is just distributed.
And in my 317-page document, there are specific reserves that are contemplated. What is not contemplated anywhere, Your Honor, and where they have not a single example, and I implore you to ask them, is Mr. Boylan right? Is there another example? Are there more than two examples where money has been distributed? We followed the letter of the law. We followed the contract, and then once it's already in the certificate holder's hands, a reserve is created, pulling it back.
Is there a provision in the PSA allowing for clawbacks?
No. Now, you can restate remittances. You could adjust some book entries. So I don't want to go too far, but the term clawback, I don't believe exists anywhere in our 317.
There is a right of indemnification that exists.
Absolutely. Your Honor, the number of times that I've had a client say, but I'm entitled to be indemnified. And then I say, well, that's great, but it's too bad they don't have money to pay your indemnification.
What happens though at the end when there isn't that much money left? And so who gets stuck with litigation costs if you can't indemnify because there's no money there?
Well, there's a couple of different things. Number one, there are examples, and they'll probably tell you all about them. There are examples of instances where for example, you get to the end of one of these enormous billion-dollar trusts, and there might be what they call cleanup costs. our expert acknowledged, yeah, sometimes reserves do happen. That is consistent with customer practice. Okay. He acknowledged that. And they use that as saying he admitted it. He admitted to sometimes that happens. What doesn't happen is this clawing back of money. So towards the end of a trust, it's a
You're saying that the indemnification reserve that isn't specifically authorized by the contract could come into existence as long as it didn't involve a clawback. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In some instances, that does happen, Your Honor.
How does that happen when it isn't specifically provided for by the contract?
Because that is something consistent with custom and practice. What is inconsistent with it is where they still have, and this is undisputed in the record, there was still a large amount of mortgage loans left in this trust. They're commercial backed, they're commercial mortgage loans, so they're enormous. The next couple of months generated another $51 million worth of cash flows. So it is not what you're kind of grappling with at the end of a trust. What happens if they're left holding the bag? What actually happened was one special servicer realized that they may be replaced in December of 2018. And after the money had already been distributed to the investors, the certificate holders, they said, oh man, we don't want to be left with our adversary in another piece of litigation telling us if we get paid or not. Let's claw back some money and make ourselves safe.
Mr. Boylan, can I come back to your contract interpretation argument? And first, would I be safe to say that all the parties believe it's unambiguous, but with different results?
Well,
the reason I'm asking is you believe it's unambiguous, unambiguously silent as to a provision, and I don't think that's disputed, authorizing the reserve for the expectation of future legal expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then
let me amend your statement a little bit. Authorizing a clawback to provide for a reserve for future anticipated legal expenses.
Well, maybe I didn't understand the district court's order that way, but maybe that's part of the error that you're addressing, because there's also not a dispute. I don't believe that there's no provision that specifically authorized under these circumstances a clawback.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
So here's my question, and this is separate from your argument, I think, about what the court did or did not do with the expert evidence. I want to separate that. Just under New York law, then, under those cases you're referring to, this implied, if it's unambiguously silent, what does New York law say then to, and I saw the phrase a commercially reasonable interpretation and implied, et cetera, is your point, the law does not get you to those, but where does it get us if it's silent? Is that a trial issue, therefore, necessarily, to finish interpretation because it's silent?
Your Honor, I don't know if you're asking me what I want, but I think you are.
Well,
is that
the part that's contrary to the judge's order when interpreting New York law and using the phrase implied? Because I'll admit for myself, anytime in contract interpretation, that phrase, what little hair I have, it's up, which you maybe can't tell. That's what I want to know about the New York law and in applying that. I thought earlier you said, well, if there's a term that's ambiguous, but here we have silence.
Well, simple thing. This isn't that complicated. If somebody does something that's not allowed under a contract by a 317-page document, there's no express provision allowing you to do something, that is an event of default, right? And that's ultimately what we asked for. Summary judgment should have been granted in our favor, because what happened here was not expressly allowed pursuant to the contract.
So your point being the error, New York law does not allow the judge to go further and consider what was implied, because it's reasonably implied. I think that makes some sense, because how do you pay? You're allowed to, but your point being is the law would not allow that if there's not an affirmative provision to do so.
And really twofold. My second point, I think you've got the first one right. The second one is it has to be reasonably implied. The reason that I went on chapter and verse about it goes to a certificate account and there's 25 instances where you get to make withdrawals, and there are rights to indemnification. And then once it hits the distribution account, okay, it's definitely coming back to the certificate holders and the investors. To imply a provision that upends all of that based upon generalities, and kind of this is the overarching what the trust is supposed to do, that's not a reasonable implied term, especially where you're upsetting the very specific terms that are were carefully negotiated by sophisticated parties in a 317-page document. And sophisticated parties just rolled out of my mouth, but go look at the case law. Go look at this New York case law, because while they're kind of right about this is Hornbook case law, they omit the rest of the story, where the case law in New York says we're really reluctant to imply these sort of terms where we have sophisticated parties who negotiated a deal. Finally, when you go look at these case law, this case law, what they're trying to do is move forward the expectations of the parties, right? Was this term to include A and B or not? What was their expectations? I'll tell you what my client's expectations were: that the certificate account rules would be respected, that when it landed in the distribution account, it would be respected. And when it was ultimately already paid to them, $38 million, they would get to keep that money. That's a reasonable expectation based upon a 317-page document. What they want to do is say, hey, based upon generalities and based upon what we kind of everybody knows should happen, let's just ignore that agreement. I'll save my last 5 minutes.
Very good. Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, and I believe we have the 8 minutes first, Palomino Azteca Partners. And so when you're ready, you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, Thomas Redburn from Lowenstein Sandler for Palomino and Azteca, who are referred to collectively as the Appaloosa appellees. So where I'd like to begin actually is getting clear on what the district court actually held. In granting summary judgment for the seniors, the district court relied on three things. First, an express provision in the PSA, section 3.01B, which says the master servicer and the special servicer have the explicit authority to take any and all actions that they deem necessary and desirable in connection with the servicing and the administration of the trust. So before the court got even to the question of implication, yes, Your Honor.
But isn't it also subject to A, which limits that to the pursuant to the agreement? So doesn't that just bring us, that really doesn't answer the question when the agreement's silent?
No, and that's exactly the point, because here the agreement is silent in both directions as to whether you can take a reserve. It's both silent as to whether there's explicit authority to take reserves in this situation, but also silent as to whether or not it's prohibited. So in that, where there's a gap in the agreement, section 3.01 comes into play in order to give the servicers the authority to manage the trust day to day under circumstances that were not perfectly anticipated when the PSA was put together back in 2007. So that's the first point. There's explicit authority for this. The second point that the district court relied on.
And that's the provision of the contract that you rely on for the authority to claw back money as well as the authority to create the reserve. I do feel that things got a little conflated in the briefing in terms of, is the conduct at issue the clawback of the money into a reserve, or is it the reserve itself? Because it seems to me that the main fight in front of the district court was the creation of the reserve itself and not the actual clawback.
And I am so glad you asked that question, Judge Larson, because you're absolutely correct. It's been a moving target throughout these proceedings as to what the respondent's position, I'm sorry, as to what Torchlight's position actually was. Was it the reserve that was the problem? Was it the clawback that was the problem? Both Mr. Cross and I examined their expert at deposition and asked him this specific question. We never got a clear answer, because sometimes it sounds like it's the reserve that's the problem. Sometimes it sounds like it's the clawback that's the problem. In the briefing to Judge Diamond below, it was the reserve that was the problem. The clawback was only mentioned as an afterthought. Now in this court, suddenly the clawbacks become a problem. But yes, to answer your original question, Your Honor, 3.01b also gives authorization for the clawback. And as Mr. Boylan indicated in his opening, remittance reports are restated all the time. And when remittance reports are restated, oftentimes the implication of that is that money has to come back from the trust because it was either distributed incorrectly or it was distributed to the wrong certificate holders. But to return back to what I was saying, the second thing that the district court relied on was the body of law that Your Honors referred to earlier, which is implying obligations into New York agreements. And what he basically said is, look, there's no dispute between the parties that the trust has to pay its bills. There's also no dispute between the parties that legitimate trust expenses have a higher priority claim to trust funds than certificate holders' distributions do. And third, there's also no dispute in the record that the master servicer and the special servicer, as fiduciaries to the trust, have an obligation to ensure that the trust doesn't become insolvent. Okay. Well, when you're now dealing with the factual situation that we have, which is the trust is down to its last few assets, $486 million has just gone out the door, and the trust knows that it's got $38 million at least in litigation, potential litigation exposure and indemnification obligations coming down the pike. And as Mr. Boylan himself conceded, there is a clear obligation in section 6.03 of the PSA that the trust has to indemnify the servicers for litigation exposure. And part of that $38 million involved a direct claim against the trust itself in the One Congress action. When you put all of that together, there has to be a mechanism under the PSA in order to ensure that the trust's ability to fulfill all of those obligations is meaningful. And that's when he looked to custom and practice, which under New York law, when you are analyzing whether a contract is ambiguous, you're always looking at it from the perspective of a reasonable person who is familiar with the customs, usages, and terminology in the industry. In other words, that's familiar with how the industry works in which where the contract's been entered into. And when he looked at custom and practice, what he saw was that everybody agreed, all of the experts, virtually every fact and expert witness who testified in the case, all agreed that the custom and practice in the industry is that the servicers are to take reserves when it is necessary in order to ensure that there is an adequate source of cash to pay liabilities that are coming down the pike.
So okay. Just to clarify, you're suggesting the judge was asked, and it didn't say so in the order, to determine whether it was ambiguous or not, and looked at custom and practice to conclude it was not, even though the judge didn't.
As a technical matter, what the court actually did is he concluded that it was unambiguous based on the language, both the express authority and what could be reasonably implied from the language. And the reason he did that was because he concluded that the interpretation that was being put forth by the juniors was not reasonable. It wasn't a fair way to construe the contract given the realities of the industry. Judge Diamond then looked to custom and practice as confirmation of his interpretation of the language.
And that, you believe, is supported by New York law? That's
absolutely
part of the areas that my little hair went up. I mean, it just seems to me that's almost necessarily a reason for the fact to go to the fact finder, because it appeared to me, but you argue differently, that there was some competing expert analysis of that issue.
It wasn't competing. There was no competing expert analysis. That's the point. And New York law is crystal clear, even if the language were ambiguous. In other words, even if Judge Diamond had concluded that the contract was ambiguous, New York law is crystal clear that where the so-called extrinsic evidence at summary judgment is so one-sided that it only supports one party's position, summary judgment can be granted, even on an ambiguous contract. The last thing
I do have one other question, and I guess maybe Appellant will be happy because I think he asked me to ask it, but is, were there any examples where a clawback was used to fund a reserve like this as opposed to reserving prior to distribution?
No, I don't believe there were any specific examples that were identified by any of the witnesses, frankly, of a clawback used in this particular situation. What there is testimony from Wells's witnesses and from a couple of the experts that sometimes you have to restate a distribution, either because you made a mistake or because there was some other basis for undermining the correctness. Oh, may I completely
yes,
answer
you
the
may.
Question? Thank you. There was some other basis for undermining what it is that you did. And so you got it as again, as a trust fiduciary, the servicers are obligated to correct that. And Mr. Aronoff, actually, who was Torchlight's expert, was asked, well, do you disagree that restatements of distributions are permissible? And he said, no, of course, happens all the time if there's an error. Well, how do you distinguish those from this situation? He couldn't answer the question. With that, unless the court has any further questions, I will turn it over to Mr. Cross.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And indeed, Mr. Cross, by agreement, you'll have the 5 minutes once you're beginning. And yes, there's an adjustment button. I
really welcome that. It's great. As old as I get, I can't, the higher I raise it now, I can tell how bad my eyesight is. Good morning. Greg Cross from Venable on behalf of CW Capital. I want to pick up with counsel's arguments, particularly on the ambiguity point. It wouldn't matter in this case if you concluded there was an ambiguity or not. I believe the trial court did correctly find there was no ambiguity because both the master and the specialist counsel argued have full power and authority to do or cause to be done anything they believe is in the interest of the trust. And it's the opposite of what was argued to you. When you have a 300-page document, you have to have that provision because the overlapping language makes it all the more complex. And that 300-page document is today 1,000 pages because people just keep adding on additional provisions. So
my question on that is then, if you're relying on the plain language of 3.01, does that then create a fact issue about what is necessary and desirable?
No, not in this case, because the evidence was absolutely uniform that reserves are created. So understand, Torchlight is not a party to the contract. The trustee is a party to the contract. The master servicer is a party to the contract. The special servicer is a party to the contract. All three testified reserves can be taken. That was completely established. There were three experts in the case. Tom Nealon, who we called, who had 25 years of industry experience, taken all the time. The expert brought forward by Appaloosa's counsel, that's what we call them, also, Mr. Ruffing similarly testified reserves can be taken. That even Mr. Aronoff, Torchlight's expert, testified they routinely occur. Now, what do we have in this case? In this trust, 75 assets, huge trust, 75 assets came into special servicer. 75 times reserves were created with respect to those assets. This is a shelf trust. It was a Wachovia trust. It was duplicated multiple times. So we went to all the duplicates, 14 trusts, 326 assets came in, 326 times reserves were created. Now, the most incredible thing about it is, in this case, this trust instructional proceeding, $32 million in reserves were taken for future litigation expenses. There has not been an objection to any of the 75, to any of the 326, or to the reserves taken in this case. Torchlight expressly doesn't challenge those $32 million of reserves taken in this case.
And is that because they weren't taken by a clawback or because—
The clawback is a bit of a sideshow because the clawback doesn't change the character and the ability to take the reserve. The clawback just goes to the ability to reclaim an errant distribution, which happens automatically. Wells is better to answer this question, but you have a normal, it's usually a 3-day right. You can just take money back. That happens just as a matter of routine. And it's something that the master servicer, actually, I guess it's the certificate administrator, is entitled to do. But again, that's a better point for Wells to answer. But it has nothing to do with the propriety of the reserve. And CW Cap.
Is that really the question that we're presented with, is the propriety of the reserve as opposed to the propriety of the clawback?
The way it was argued to the trial judge, it was the propriety of the reserve. There was really no challenge legally to the propriety of the clawback. It was just a sense of indignation that the money was clawed back. But on the indignation point, I want to make this point. What was at issue in these underlying cases? It was an overdistribution of money at a time that they owned the certificates. They don't want to pay back the money. They would rather the next guy pay back the money. So there wasn't an unfairness to it, but the clawback that was argued below was argued more as an equities. Hey, we got our money and then they took it away from us. That was really the argument. But again, the Wells can speak to CW Capital has nothing to do with the act of clawing back because the special servicer just says, hey, we need the money.
Well, I guess then my question is, I guess it's not clear to me in the record why this request didn't come from your client, you know, 3 days earlier so that this reserve was created prior to the distribution. Is that something that is elicited? Because I do think that the argument that they're making is if you're relying on 3.01 and you have to prove that it's necessary, does the record show under a de novo standard necessarily that it was necessary if other money was going to come in that would have gone to the higher certificate holders versus taking it from this fund, which then, you know, hurts the juniors.
So I can speak directly to that because just like the evidence was uniform with respect to the ability to take the reserves, the evidence was uniform with respect to the need for the reserves. So in December of 2018, $480 million or so had been passed through because the assets had been sold. There were only five assets left. All of them were troubled and in special servicing. It was 1.26% of the trust. There was no way to adjudicate or time when money would come in from those assets. CW Capital was replaced as special servicer. Another thing that doesn't appear in the PSA is that when the special servicer is replaced, they continue on to administer the litigation. So CW Capital raised its hand and said, we're going to continue to administer this litigation. We have exposure. We're going to trial in the summer on a matter where counsel says between legal fees and exposure, it's going to cost $28 million. And we've had an ongoing litigation. Actually, I was arguing with this counsel for that, during that litigation, where we're going to need $10 million to fund that litigation. Chairman of CW Capital called counsel, happened to be me. I estimated what the total costs were, and we said we're going to need $38 million. Wells Fargo's representative said there's no way the cash flows here are going to support $38 million. They don't dispute any of that. The cash flows monthly were $300,000. We settled this case in May of that year for $9 million, freeing up $17 million. There would not have been $9 million distributable in May to pay that. What Torchlight would say is, well, you just take the reserve out of one of the five assets when they liquidate in the future, which is the same thing, right? The special servicer and the master servicer are tasked with making that decision. There was no question, and it is not disputed, that the factors considered by CW in taking the distribution, Mr. Aronoff testified, are the same factors he would have looked at. What's the exposure? What's the cash? What's the timing? Their own expert conceded that was the same. There's no dispute that it is CW Capital's call and the master servicer's call to determine when do we need to do this? And there is no dispute that had we not taken the reserve, we couldn't have settled the litigation that freed up the cash that's now remaining to be distributed. It would not have existed. Torchlight would, the best they come up with is, well, you should have tried to time your settlements so they precisely matched with liquidations of troubled assets that were in special servicing. And as the trial judge correctly pointed out, nothing in the PSA requires that level of precision, nor would it be possible. And if we went down that path, you would render the indemnification provisions completely meaningless. Look, this is an enormous, I'm way over time, so I'm sorry.
You are, I was going to mention that.
Yeah, I'm going to sit down. But this is an enormous issue in this industry. And if the court were to say it's improper, you would completely upend it. There's a reason it's 326 out of 326. It happens all day long. And there's a reason the New York courts allow you to look at a custom and practice to read this type of provision to prevent exactly this. A one-off interested party from coming into a contract where everybody says this is the way you read it and say do something else. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. And now counsel for Wells Fargo. Time will really fly, I suspect, for you. You may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Matt McGuire of Alston & Byrd. I'm appearing today on behalf of Wells Fargo Bank. I will do my best, given my obviously limited time, to avoid repeating arguments, but I want to touch briefly on two things. First, in addition to the other provisions of New York law that have been touched upon, contract provisions cannot be interpreted in a manner which render another provision meaningless or to produce an absurd result one that is commercially unreasonable, or one that is contrary to the interests of the parties. Now, Mr. Cross just explained the interests of the parties to this contract are wholly aligned. We have an outsider to the contract that is coming in to upset the apple cart. The district court was correct when it noted that the appellant's proposed interpretation of the PSA would lead to absurd results. The indemnification obligations of the PSA could simply not be fulfilled without the ability to take reserves. As Mr. Cross explained, we had a diminishing and troubled pool of assets in December of 2018, which the district court noted in its order at page 4. Only 1.46% of the original principal balance was left. All five assets were extremely troubled. Servicers like CW and Wells Fargo cannot predict. We do not have crystal balls. We do not have the ability to ascertain the future performance of remaining loans, particularly when they are in special servicing. Appellants would have this court impose an impossible standard that requires servicers like Wells Fargo to predict the future. Under their interpretation, a trust that distributes funds to certificate holders would face being unable to satisfy its senior indemnification obligations to administrators. The provisions of the PSA clearly protect the trust from that risk. And in fact, they mandate that my client make sure it does everything possible to keep that trust solvent. To act as appellants argue would effectively compel the master servicer and the special servicer to violate the servicing standard, which no one has mentioned here. That is the Bible as far as my client is concerned. It is expressly defined in the PSA, and it requires us to act as a prudent person in administering the trust. Obviously, I will be brief because that's all I can be. But if your honors have any questions, I'll be happy to address them.
Appears not. Thank you, counsel. Appreciate it. Ms. Boylan, you'll now have 5 minutes of rebuttals. When you're ready, you may proceed.
Mr. Cross is considerably taller than he looks on Zoom. So thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to be brief. There's a number of points that were raised. 3.01B, this broad grant of any and all actions, I think you've already got it. You got to go up and look at pursuant to the terms of the agreement. Building off that same concept, Wells Fargo just argued exactly what I was saying earlier. New York law is not that different from Minnesota law. You can't read the contract in a way that eviscerates other portions of the contract. There would be no meaning to 3.05 if they were allowed to take clawbacks after everything had already been a permitted withdrawal pursuant to that provision. We've heard a lot about how there is no record, there's no dispute, it's admitted, et cetera. Go take a look. And this is de novo review, so I know I can count on this court doing it. Docket number 423. It's the Aronoff report. There, he lays out exactly his disagreement. And there are some agreements. There's some concessions. Of course, some reserves happen sometimes. But a reserve like this would be contrary to custom and practice. And it would be contrary to expectations. Similarly, and I like it as a rhetorical argument, 326 of 326 kind of resonates with you. All of those did not deal with a circumstance like this. There were reserves taken, sure, but they were in connection with a loan liquidation. A lawyer is busy generating a bill. They know it's coming. They make a reserve to make sure that lawyer gets paid in connection with that. Or it's at the end of one of these extended documents and they set aside a little bit of money because they know there's going to be some expenses that we're incurring as we're finishing the trust. Those sorts of reserves are not what we're dealing with here. And frankly, I think it blew back whatever hair Judge Diamond's got, that everybody's in agreement that this can't be the way it's read, that everybody's in agreement this is what custom and practice dictates. The problem is there is no provision in this contract that allows for this. And everybody agrees on that. Under those circumstances, we've got to be sent to a trier of fact. And look, it may be that ultimately I'm wrong or my client is wrong. But in a case like this, where there is no contractual provision at stake, I've been in trials where at the beginning, folks are skeptical. And then by the end of the trial, it turns out that when you consider the credibility of witnesses and when you actually sit with the facts, when you understand the facts, when you have the criticism of the 326 of 326 sink in, a different decision comes out. And that's why you have trials in cases like this. Finally, there's—
Are we required under New York law, if we think this contract is ambiguous, to remand for a trial?
Maybe. I mean, frankly, I'll give them some credit. The court does go forward in some of those cases, almost uniformly, the cases that they said about New York law will say, here's an ambiguity.
Because in Minnesota, we would usually, okay.
Totally agree with you. Where I will give them a little bit of credit, frankly, is sometimes the court goes forward and says, okay, there's an ambiguity. Now I get to look at that and I'm going to try to interpret it to decide this issue maybe. But what the court doesn't do under those circumstances is reach an unreasonable interpretation that ignores provisions within the contract or relies on some and says, you know, if I don't give them what they want here, the right to indemnification might be meaningless. What does that mean? Is an unfunded right to indemnification meaningless? I don't think so. It's just an unfunded right to indemnification. It's those sorts of things that you can't, in the New York law, when you go review it, Your Honor, you will see that they go so far, but if they can't conclusively decide it, it is remanded for a trial on the ambiguity. And frankly, here we have no ambiguity. There is no provision, the court concluded, explicitly authorizing this. This is not complicated. If I do something that's not allowed by a contract, that's not allowed. And that's what we have here. That's all that I have to say.
Well, thank you all, counsel. We appreciate you bringing some concision to the size of the file, albeit from different results that you're arguing and wanting, but we appreciate that. We will take the matter under advisement. Within 90 days, you'll be receiving our ruling. Have a good day. Thank you.
All rise.